This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Here are some terms you may have heard or even used before. Sadie Hawkins Day, Kickapoo Joy Juice, even a place called Lower Slabovia. Actually, I've used that term a lot, and I didn't know where it came from. All of the above and more originated in a comic strip that captivated America for 43 years. Al Capp's Lil Abner. This strip that took place at the intersection of American innocence and political cynicism had 60 million readers at the peak of its popularity and went on to become both a Broadway and movie musical featuring the strip's lead character, a 6'3" hillbilly named Abner Yoakum. Now, he wasn't too bright, and he pretty much ignored a knockout named Daisy May, but he sure knew what he wanted in life.
Say, Abner, if you could be anyone else in the whole world, who'd you druther be?
Me?
Just you?
Just me.
What's so special about being you?
Ain't nothing special about it. It's just so handy, that's all. If I had my druthers to choose from all the others, I'd druther be like I am. This thing called employment detracts from my enjoyment and tightens my diaphragm. While I'm doing nary a thing that's necessary, I'm happy as a cherry stone clam. If I had my druthers to choose from all the others, I'd druther be like I am, yes, ma'am. I'd druther be like I am.
Well, that is from the original 1956 recording of Lil Abner, featuring the voice of the man who originated the title role, Peter Palmer. And believe it or not, he joins us now. Mr. Palmer, welcome to the program.
Boy, was he young.
If I did the math right, you were 25 then. Is that correct?
No, I was 24.
Okay.
But your math isn't that far off.
Which makes you today, at least 38.
82.
Well, congratulations.
83. When I started the show, I was 23.
Gracious.
And a few weeks later, I turned to 24.
Well, Peter Palmer is here because the musical Lil Abner. Lil Abner is part of CPCC Summer Theater's 41st season, and with us in the studio is the young man who plays the perpetually 19-year-old Abner in that production, Zach Teague. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
You're very tall.
Oh, thank you. Good to be talking.
Yeah, and Tom Hollis is director of both this production, which plays through the weekend, and artistic director of the summer season. This is the second time that he's directed Lil Abner. The first time he directed it was his first directing gig more than 200 productions ago. What took you so long to get around to it again?
Go ahead. It just takes a while to cycle things through. There's always something new, and now I'm entering my 60s and starting to revisit some things that I've always wanted to do again.
Okay. Well, Lil Abner opened, as I said, in 1956. It was directed by the famous Michael Kidd, lyrics by Johnny Mercer. Had Edie Adams, my God, Edie Adams as Daisy May. And Peter, you in the title role. 400 actors auditioned to be Lil Abner because this was a big deal back then. And you got the part at a time when you were virtually unknown. How did that happen?
Well, I had won the All Army Entertainment Contest. I was in the service. I was stationed at Fort Sam Houston, Brooke Army Medical Center. And I went to New York, and I was on the Ed Sullivan Show. They were watching another network that was promoting a play or a movie called That Certain Feeling with Bob Hope, and it was about Al Capp. I mean, the story was basically about him. It was a cartoonist, the whole thing. During the commercial, they flipped over, and I was singing Granada. And the one producer turned to the other one, who were also the writers. And by the way, they did all the road pictures for Bob Hope and,
Bing Crosby.
And Bing Crosby. Anyway, the one guy said, "That kid, he's really familiar. I think he's worked for us." And the other guy said, "No." And he said, "No, look at him. We know him." He said, "No, that's our little actor."
I'll be darned.
Well, I went to visit my parents in Chicago, and I didn't have enough money to have a phone in my place with my wife and baby down in San Antonio. So they got my next door neighbor who said I was up here, up in Chicago. They called me, and I went into New York and auditioned, and they said, "You're it. What's your Army status?" And I said, "I'm getting out in 6 months." They said, "Well, we need you in 3. I said, "Well, I could probably get out on an early release." And they said, "Well, terrific. We know a lot of people in Washington." I said, please don't go from Washington down, because I said, "I know everybody at Brook Army Medical Center, and it's easier because I know how the Army works. You know, some guy will get my papers and just put it in the in or out box."
But long story short, I guess they either waited for you or you got out early and you got the part, and the rest is, history, right?
You know, I had played a lot of football, and I was really buff at that time. I don't know. You see the pictures. But I had played on 2 Big Ten championship teams and the Rose Bowl championship.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in a second, because it's unusual that a football player becomes a musical comedy personality. It doesn't happen that often. But I'll bet you, Zach, that your experience is precisely what Peter Palmer's.
That's exactly what it is.
I know that a lot of people audition for summer theater. How many audition for summer theater?
Normally we have a little over 1,000 people in auditions.
It's amazing. It's like a machine every summer, every spring before you do that. So out of the thousands of people, they chose you to be Little Abner. Little Abner was a remarkable phenomenon as a comic strip for 43 years, and then became this Broadway show, and later on a movie, which also starred Peter Palmer. But were you at all familiar? Because it's been out of the newspaper since the 70s. Were you at all familiar with Little Abner?
Actually, not at all. I was not familiar. When I found out I had gotten the role, I was like, "What is this show?" And I asked my parents about it, and they're like, "Little Abner? You don't know Little Abner?" And supposedly they had like grown up on it, and but no, I didn't know about Little Abner at all.
You know, there have been a couple of Broadway musicals that were derived from comic strips. Good Man Charlie Brown is an obvious one. There was one that I think got a workshop when I was in college, based on The Wizard of Id, believe it or not. But you can never find enough. A guy short enough to play the king that had a big enough nose to get away with it. Is this one of the few musical stuff that came from a?
There have been just a handful. They attempted a Doonesbury musical at one point, and I think Kudzu turned into a brief musical. But this one has endured, like the Charlie Brown.
You know, Little Abner played nearly 700 performances on Broadway, and it had a really interesting cast of people in it. I don't know that, aside from Edie Adams, that people, and maybe Stubby Kaye, who had done Guys and Dolls prior to this, that people knew all of these people in this show, Peter. But I went through the list of people, and there are people like Julie Newmar and Charlotte Ray. And somebody said somewhere along the line, maybe she was just in the chorus, that Valerie Harper was in the original cast. Is that right?
That's true. I remember when they bought, Valerie didn't open with us, but she came in about halfway through the show. She was 16 and very, very zoftic. She was, I look at her, and boy, could she dance and sing. So, you know, she came in and that show spoiled me for every show I did after that. I probably have done 5,000 performances of about 40 different musicals and plays, and I got to tell you, it just ruined me for the rest of them because we were so close because we were all young.
Yeah.
Look at the movie. I mean, there was just some of the leads were older, but everybody else, and I'm sure that Hollis has cast the show because it's Drop Dead Beautiful Girls and Ugly Guys.
Well, now, wait a minute. I saw you as a young man. As a matter of fact, I watched a clip of you in the movie version of this yesterday. I want to listen to a piece of a duet between you and the woman who ultimately played Daisy May in the movie, Leslie Parrish, and a song called Namely You. This is our guest, Peter Palmer.
You deserve someone good-looking, namely me. Someone who as yet ain't tooken, namely me. That is how I'll remain unless you get me, shall we say, in the family way. Come next Sadie Hawkins Day. You crave arms to make you tingle, namely mine. To a bachelor who's single, that sounds fine. Comes the day I no longer bachel, naturally I'll be. And who could I be truest to? Namely, you.
That is from the movie version of Lil Abner.
Which hey, also... by the way, that girl that sang, Leslie did not sing it.
Oh, that was her voice?
It was pre-recorded. Somebody else and Dixon, who did My Fair Lady, is the movie, as a matter of fact.
Well, why didn't
he did about five or six of those.
Why didn't they put Edie Adams in the movie? She was a big star back then.
She had just had a baby.
Ah. People don't remember Edie Adams probably today, but she was on television constantly in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
Wasn't she married to Ernie Kovacs?
Yes, she was.
Yeah.
She was, and I've spent a lot of time with the both of them. You know, I want to tell you, who is the guy doing Little Abner there?
Oh, yes.
I'm here.
I wasn't introduced, so I don't know.
No, he's here. Zach Teague.
Okay. Tell him all you have to do is how old is he?
I'm 21.
21.
21.
Well, I played him like a 19-year-old with a 12-year-old mind.
right.
Well, you can't. You're 21. You can't remember what it was like to be 19, can you?
That was quite a while ago. A few moons.
I want to come back and talk about that because it takes some intelligence, it seems to me, to be a good actor, because you have to be able to analyze a script and figure out what your role in that, what you're playing in terms of your character. So you have to be pretty intelligent. But in this role, you're not. So I want to find out what that's like when we come back from the break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Penland School of Crafts, presenting a gala weekend craft auction in the North Carolina mountains on August 8th and 9th. Details at penland.org. Today's kids are connected to video games, computers, cell phones, TV, but all those connections are leaving them increasingly disconnected from nature. They have what Richard Louv calls nature deficit disorder, and he says there is a growing body of evidence linking the lack of nature in children's lives to the rise in obesity, ADD, and depression. He will tell us more about his movement to leave no child inside tomorrow morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, tackling government dysfunction, a panel including former Senator Olympia Snowe and law professor Larry Lessig on new bipartisan efforts to reduce government gridlock and the influence of big donors.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
When we fought the Yankees and annihilation was near, who was there to lead the charge that took us safe to the rear? Why, it was Jubilation T. Cornpone. All toot your own horn, Pone. Jubilation T. Cornpone, a man who knew no fear.
Tell us what,
yes, tell us. Yeah,
what else did he do?
When we almost had him, but the issue still was in doubt. Who suggested the retreat that turned it into a rout? Why, it was
Jubilation T. Cornpone!
Erect! All tattered and torn, Pone.
Jubilation T. Cornpone, he kept us hiding out.
With our ammunition gone and faced with utter defeat, who was it that burned the crops and left us nothing to eat?
Why, it was Jubilation T. Cornpone!
Old September morn, Pone.
Jubilation T. Cornpone.
The pants blown off his seat.
Hooray!
A little example of the subversive nature of Al Capp's comic strip and also the lyrics by Johnny Mercer to Lil Abner, because that this play takes place in Kentucky, which is the South, and yet they're mercilessly making fun of the Confederacy, among other things, in the course of this play. We're with Peter Palmer, who played Lil Abner originally in the 1956 production of Lil Abner on Broadway, and in the movie, Zach Tigg plays him through the weekend, because they've been running for a week or so, at CPCC Summer Theater, and Tom Hollis is the director of that production and also the artistic director of CPCC Theater and Summer Theater as well. I want to talk about intelligence because actors have to be pretty smart. And I'm going to begin with you, Zach. You have to be pretty smart to be an actor, but you're playing a character who's as dumb as a box of rocks.
Right.
He's not even attracted to Daisy May, for crying out loud, and she's a knockout.
Right.
So talk to me about how you approach that.
Well, what was difficult for me when I first read the script and looked at the comic strips was playing this 19-year-old who is extremely gullible and who is extremely innocent and has the mind, like Peter said, of a 12-year-old. What I struggled with most was maintaining that manliness and not coming off as a child, but having the mindset of a child. I mean, he doesn't have the mindset of a child, but that's what I struggled with most. And to have this campy script and not to come off campy. Do you know what I'm
like
saying?
Aw shucks.
Yeah, like aw shucks. Yeah, I didn't want to come off that way. That's what was most difficult for me.
Of course, when you did this role, the comic strip was at the height of its popularity. So people knew this character really well and got this character. But it also, it seems to me, Peter, that it might have caused you a challenge because you were taking this one-dimensional line-drawn character off the page and putting him on a stage, and there were expectations associated with that. So how did you get around the expectations and realize him fully as a stage character?
Well, I went back to what I knew at that time, which was called survival. as an actor, I had done, I was the first music major to letter in football at Illinois, and I was the next, touted as the next Heldon tenor opera. And as a matter of fact, Johnny Mercer came to me one day and said, "Peter, you know, you're singing too legit."
Hmm.
And that really screwed me up for a while. Anyway, I had done three performances of Girl Crazy, three performances of Roberta of these 40 musicals, and three of Oklahoma, which was my last, and that's what I used when I auditioned. That's the only accent I really knew. I was from St. Louis. Anyway, so I didn't have any acting lessons at all, but boy, I could sing because I used to open up the home games with the Star Spangled Banner. and then play.
Yeah.
So they, you know, and that was fantastic for me. And you know, that got 70,000 people. What, Broadway? What's that? And I was about as naive as Little Abner really was.
Yeah, I'm curious about, because you played in Big Ten championships, and you played in the Rose Bowl in 1952.
Right.
And in your spare time.
That's prehistoric, by the way.
Yeah, but you were majoring in music. So what did your football buddies think about you being a singer?
They all wondered what I was doing there. As a matter of fact, a couple of them said, "Peter, if I could sing, I wouldn't be playing football." What are you doing? And I got to say, and I just realized this in the last few years, I was a heck of a high school football player. And, of course, I was on a full scholarship at Illinois. Somewhere along the line when I was in Illinois, I came in as a football player who sang. And somewhere along the line, because I was full-time studying voice and you know, theory and all of that, and I became a singer who played football. And I could have been a lot better than I was. And I'm a little bit sorry about that, but then I'm not, because, you know, I got my start so early as I tell kids that I teach.
But I think that is illustrative of what has happened to the business, the theater business, because you, Zach, are majoring in musical theater.
Yes,
at Elon, and that's a school that's made a reputation for itself in turning out some really talented musical theater performers over the last 10 or 15 years. And if you don't have that background, it would be nearly impossible to achieve what Peter did in the 1950s.
Yeah. Today, it's really important to major in that in order to have your career set for you.
But it's up to competition, because now, if you look at the Tony, I have a reel of all of the Tony Award-winning numbers that were all the Tony nominees that have been performed on the Tony telecast since the very beginning. I have a reel of that, and when you look back just to the 70s, these people couldn't be on a stage with you.
Right,
because the level of competence, talent, and expertise at the college level has changed so dramatically.
Right.
So, what's the competition like out there?
In college?
Yeah.
Well, I remember when I got to school, the director of the music theater, the coordinator of the music theater program, sat us down and was like, "It'll be easier to get cast on Broadway than it is to get cast at Elon," which she was. Exaggerating a little bit, but at Elon, the competition's so fierce that it's hard.
Excuse me, take that music out. Take the music out. Go ahead, I'm sorry to interrupt.
It's extremely difficult to get cast at Elon because the competition is so fierce. But then we leave Elon, we go to places like SCTC, how I got cast here, and summer stock places, and they, just because we don't have things handed to us, we are prepared for the real world and to go out and get ready for auditions and...
For those who don't know, Summer Theater is 41 years old. It's been going, God, when did it start? What's 41 minus 2014?
73.
You've turned out a lot of people. You've used a lot of people. People have come across the stage at Pease Auditorium and now the Halton, who have gone on to successful Broadway
careers. Yeah, we're very proud of our alumni. In fact, one of our young men, Matt DeGuzman, just announced yesterday he's been chosen for the national tour of Pippin, which will be coming to Charlotte next year.
Yes, they just announced the cast for that show.
We've got several alumni working on Broadway right now.
Yeah, which has to be fairly. You have to take some pride in that.
We do,
You picked them when they were just starting out.
We say, "Come to CPCC Summer Theater to see the future stars of tomorrow."
Yeah, well, and in many cases that is true. You opened with the season with the Scarlet Pimpernel, which is a Frank Wildhorn show. And then you've moved on to Little Abner. What's coming up?
Coming up next Wednesday, we open Little Mermaid Jr. for the kids. Zach will be playing Prince Eric in that, another leading man for him. And then on Friday, we open Over the River and Through the Woods. We always do a comedy as part of the season in Pease Auditorium. And then we will start rehearsals on Monday for our final show of the season, Mary Poppins, the practically perfect musical.
For people who don't know about summer theater and don't know what the machinations are, it's really a throwback to the Straw Hat Circuit and summer. What do they used to call that? Oh, darn. Oh, well, I'm old and I can't remember anything anymore. but you guys come in for four or five, six plays over the course of, I don't know,
nine weeks.
Yeah, the actors are here for 9, the technicians are here for 10.
That is a lot of material because you come in not really knowing anything.
Right.
And you learn the whole show in a week and a half.
Right.
You do it for a week and a half, 2 weeks, and then you're on to the next. And while you're rehearsing, performing at night, you're rehearsing the next show in the daytime.
Right.
What's that like?
It's exhausting. No, nothing could have prepared me for that. But I've really learned a lot about myself and how to take care of my voice and my body, because my body is my career. So I've really learned how to take care of myself. And it's really funny. Like, some days I'll get to rehearsal and I'm like, okay, what show am I doing today? I have to sit down and think about what am I about to do?
Because people don't understand, it's not just memorizing the script, it's developing a character, it's learning the dances, it's learning the songs, it's learning where you're supposed to be, and you better be there at the time you're supposed to be there. It's a lot to remember.
It is. It's a lot to remember. It's a lot to take on. But you, in any spare time you have, 5 minutes, you sit down, you read your script, you don't diddle-daddle. But it's definitely been worth it.
And Peter, you went on to do, from Little Abner, you went on to do the movie and several other movies, and you were in TV shows, including Dallas for a while. And then I understand that after you decided to retire, you've moved to Florida, and you've been involved with the local community theater there. That's a kind of a neat thing. They must be thrilled to have you with them.
Well, I don't want to get into that. There's a, you know, when you get on... I hate to say this. There's so many people who knew so much more than I did in community theater, because all you had to do was ask them.
Boy, you hit
I just heard this last conversation, and I'm going to tell you, I'm going to give... There are two things I've learned in my career. Uta Hawkins said to me one day, Peter, be very careful who you study with, because they'll teach you what killed their careers. And I've taken that, I got to tell you. But one thing that I got to, Zach and the rest of the actors, being a professional, you know, it working in the community theater, working with people who should be professional that don't make money at it, and they got other jobs and the whole thing, that being a professional has nothing to do with what you do. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, the talent, the training, whatever, that's what you do. It's what you don't do that makes you the professional. Because if you do go out and I tell her, well, do they do what I read they do? I said, how long would you last if you did what you read they do? Well, about 10 minutes. I said, right, and so do they. So it's all hype. So be careful what you read. The ones that don't make it die,
right?
You know, drugs, whatever. And my wife and I never took it. Never. And we were at parties where they had cocaine and oh God. And you know, come on, Pete, it's not going to hurt you. Come on, Anika, my wife, who also was a performer. And no, it's not going to hurt you. And I said, no, thank you. I said, I got to tell you.
Wow. So, words to live by.
Right.
Literally. Words to live
exactly
by.
Exactly.
If people want to come see the show, how do you do it?
You call the box office, 704-330-6835, or go online and look up CPCC TIX, T-I-X, and you can order them online 24/7.
That's so much easier.
It is.
CPCC TIX, dot... org.
It's tix.cpcc.edu.
Okay. That's Tom Hollis, Artistic Director of CPCC Summer Theater. Zach Tigg is playing Little Abner through the weekend. And Peter Palmer originated the role both on Broadway and in the movie. And you can see him as a young man anytime you want to on YouTube, as a matter of fact, because that's where I saw him yesterday. Thank you all three for being with us this hour. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
And thank you, Peter, for joining us, too. All right, let's change topics. Let's do a 180 here. It's a topic we frequent on this program. And when we do, We usually hear from politicians and policymakers, parents and administrators, but now we're going to hear from educators, many of whom have gathered in Denver, Colorado this week for the National Education Association's annual meeting and representative assembly. And joining us is the Vice President of the North Carolina Association of Educators, Mark Jewell, who is a 26-year veteran of the classroom, with the majority of his teaching occurring as a fourth and fifth grade teacher. My God, I salute you. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here with you and certainly to talk about the great work that our teachers and students are doing out there.
There's been a lot going on in American public education in recent years. Do teachers sometimes feel as though they can't keep up?
Yeah, that is exactly how they feel. And sometimes, you know, we just tell, our colleagues out there, you just have to close your nose, close your doors and shut yourself out to all the noise out there and focus on those kids that are in your classroom, because there's so much debate. And every time you turn around, there's a new program, a new curriculum, new legislation coming out, and more hoops for our teachers to jump through, that it does become exhausting and overwhelming.
You know, teachers are on the front lines of American education, and sometimes it appears as though they are the ones least listened to. Do teachers feel that their voices are being heard?
I think that they do. We have definitely made a strong attempt to turn up the volume, as you know, you've seen demonstrated this year and also last year when the 2013 budget came out. Because everyone is affected somehow by what's happened the past 2 years in North Carolina's with North Carolina's General Assembly and the budget, and we do feel like we're making a difference, because just what we saw yesterday, it was the action of North Carolina Association educators and our teachers out there that were really forcing the governor's hand to have this press conference with Speaker Tillis. You know, they're not insulated. They're looking at the at the poll numbers. They know that that's the number one priority with this election cycle coming up. Even though the governor's not on the ballot, he really is on the ballot. Because if the folks come out there and decide that the policies that this General Assembly are voting on are not the way that North Carolina should be going, then he realizes that the state's going to go in a different direction.
Well, even before some of these budget talks and other Common Core standard discussions going on now in the legislature, even before all that happened, we've been asking public schools to do a lot of different things other than simply educate kids, and a lot of kids come to school carrying a lot of baggage which has nothing to do with education, and yet teachers have to be equipped to handle that in the classroom, and they're being held responsible for that in the classroom. At the same time, world competition is upping the ante on educational outcomes, and teachers are shouldering all of that responsibility for those outcomes. So are we being fair, or are we handicapping teachers out of the gate?
Yeah, there are definitely, there's so many variables that affect student achievement. Our number one, message out there is that every child should be learning and growing, but every child does not learn at the same rate or in the same way. So in order to be able to reach all those different specialities of our students, you've got to have more adults, working with them. You've got to have smaller class size, and you've got to be able to, of course, recruit that type of talent that is going to get our people into their classrooms.
Mark Jewell is the Vice President of the North Carolina Association of Educators. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. We have to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction on East Independence Boulevard inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. Well, coming up on the Diane Rehm Show today in 20 minutes, the panel, including former U.S. Senator Olympia Snowe and law professor Larry Lessig, will talk about the new bipartisan efforts to reduce government gridlock and the influence of big donors. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. When we come back, more about Lil Abner at CPCC Summer Theater. Stay with us.
Ah, my first car. It was a 62 Chevy Bel Air. Oh, it was magnificent.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers.
No, it was a piece of junk. In fact, this car had the dubious distinction of using more oil than it did gasoline. I'd pull into the gas station and I'd say, fill the oil and check the gas. Now, wouldn't it be great if even a car like that could be turned into the programs that you love?
Call 1-866-789-8627.
Or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mark Jewell is our guest. He's the vice president of the North Carolina Educator Association of Educators. The president, Rodney Ellis, the president of your organization, wrote an open letter to members of the North Carolina General Assembly in which he said that this General Assembly has chosen to abandon our public school system. He wrote, for generations, the compact for North Carolina educators was that in exchange for modest salaries, the state would ensure due process protections from arbitrary dismissal, as well as excellent benefits. And now with this budget, we shatter the compact with teachers in an attempt to silence educators who wish to speak out on critical issues affecting the classroom and the students we serve. And today, he said, you are placing a sign on each school's door that says, quality educators need not apply. Pretty strong words.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up that topic of tenure, as the governor and the General Assembly like to call it. We call it, it's actually due process, right? It's not tenure as it is in the university system, which, you know, basically says it's a job for life. That is not the case. What this tenure does in North Carolina lets the teacher request a hearing should they feel like that they're being capriciously or arbitrarily dismissed. That's all it does. And asking to have their case represented in front of a board.
I got to tell you, that's the first time I've heard that definition of tenure at the secondary and elementary school level.
Yeah,
it's being pushed as absolutely comparable, apples to apples, with college tenure.
Yeah, and that we're really trying to get that message out, Mike, by saying, you know, we don't call it tenure. It's career status in North Carolina, which means after you put through four successful years of teaching, then you're offered what's called a continuing contract, okay? But it doesn't mean that you're going to have a job for life. You're still being evaluated mandated three times a year. There's somebody in your classroom every day, as there should be, making sure that the kids' needs are being met. And if you have 5 years or 15 years or 5 months, you can still be dismissed under North Carolina law for, as a drop of the hat, for 15 different reasons on grounds for dismissal at the drop of the hat.
Well, if that is true, why are there members of the assembly who would like to trade pay raises for tenure?
You know what? I think that they're using it as a way to silence teachers. Because many times, as we've become very vocal over the voucher issue, they didn't like that. We became very vocal over teacher pay issue. They tried to take away the our right to be able to have our dues deductions, you know, from our paycheck. So, in order, you know, they don't like us questioning the policies that go on. So we see these two things as going hand in hand. You know, speaking out in public education policy and protecting a teacher's rights, okay? Because back in the day, it was put in there for a reason, and that was because that many times politics got involved in the hiring of teachers, and it became, you know, a point where, well, you may have needed a family friend a job, so you would, you know, get this math position at this high school. And so we had to put some protections in there to making sure that teachers weren't just paid to the politics of the local community there. Tenure was actually an innovative idea back in the 1920s by college professors and think tanks who said, listen, we can't pay our teachers in America very well, but how can we get them to come into the profession? And they looked at Germany, and it was a model in Germany, and they offered these due process or tenure rights, which was just simple protections so that they couldn't be uniquely vulnerable to the politics of their communities. And that's where it started, okay? And, you know, I worked in HR with Guilford County Schools for the past 3 years. You know, if there's an underperformer in the classroom and we've provided the support with them and they're still not developing and not cutting the mustard there, they don't last.
Yeah.
They're typically not fired because they resign out before it gets to that point. They leave with some dignity.
Let's talk about teacher pay for a second. There are a lot of different plans in the legislature. The Senate has a plan. The House has a plan. Yesterday, the governor and Tom Tillis introduced yet a third plan and cut the Senate out of it. The House plan, and we'll talk about all these, but the House plan proposes to raise teacher pay by 5% and pay for that raise, at least partly, by getting people to buy more lottery tickets. I thought that the lottery for education was supposed to support education from the get-go. What has it provided, to the best of your knowledge, thus far?
Yes, it is. You know, I'm glad you brought that point up there, because our question is, we do have some apprehension about this special budget that was pulled out yesterday that just deals with teacher pay and education issues. You know, and our it does have in there an average 5% raise, but the sustainability is in question. We're, like you said, we're gambling on gambling. We're gambling that people are going to buy more tickets. And, you know, when the lottery came into effect, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, it was meant to supplement public school funding, but not to supplant it. It takes about $1 billion for advertising. It takes about $1 billion in gifts. So there's a very little amount of money that goes into other programs such as pre-K, such as school building, a little bit for class size, lowering class size with hiring extra people. So it's very sketchy to say that, you know, we're going to fund a sustainable pay raise every year on a continuing budget with lottery tickets. You know, if you look at any other state that has a strong, well-funded public school system, it's because they have a strong tax base. And, you know, what the General Assembly decided to do last year by giving billionaires tax breaks and corporations tax breaks, that's defunding schools by $500 million every year. $2 billion over the next 5 years are not going into public schools. So they really don't know how to fund any of these plans. That's why you're looking at surcharges on dry cleaning and movie tickets. I mean, that's not how you're going to be able to get teachers in here and fund their salaries. So it's very worrisome.
Well, there are a couple of plans floating around, as I said, and in the Senate wants to give teachers an 11% raise, which sounds nice, but the trade-off, of course, would be giving up tenure and getting rid of half of the teaching assistants. But meanwhile, yesterday, Governor McCrory, along with Tom Tillis, who's the Speaker of the House and who is also running for the United States Senate, made an announcement at the governor's mansion and said that the provisions of the House budget that dealt with teacher pay would be pulled out and submitted as a separate bill. This new bill would give 5% raises to teachers, does not require teachers to give up their tenure, does not cut teachers' assistance, provides slightly more money for textbooks, and adds $11.8 million to cover expanding vouchers for students to go to private schools. Now, I know your organization doesn't like the voucher idea, but how do you feel about the rest of this?
Right. The other things that you mentioned, you know, that's good news. You know, we support, you know, of course, you know, the average 5% salary increase is desperately needed in order to keep our teachers here and recruit teachers. You know, not having to trade, sell their tenure. Of course, we support, you know, that. We just won a court battle on that last month. Preserving jobs of our teacher assistants, those indicators right there we support, you know, wholeheartedly. The vouchers, a big problem for us in that budget. You know, we think it's unconstitutional, and we think that taking public dollars and funneling them into private schools with no accountability, no regulation, is dangerous. So it's, you know, we don't know. We're almost saying we've been fooled by this House before. Is this a smoke screen? You know, they still have to go back to the Senate. The Senate was completely left out of that press conference yesterday. They're already reporting in the paper they know nothing about it. They don't think that it's a sustainable plan. and more or less, you know, snub their nose at it.
Well, let me ask you this, because we have these two plans, the governor and the House in league with each other, and then the Senate plan. And as I said, the governor's plan, it gives 5% raises to teachers without having to give up tenure, while the Senate plan has an 11% raise for teachers, yeah, but you have to give up tenure to get it. So if you had to vote today, which is better?
Yeah. Oh, hands down, the House budget.
And so you'd rather have a 5% raise and keep tenure?
Let me tell you about that 11%. The 11% is coming on the back of other school employees, which is wrong, which is going to increase the workload about it. And the 11% is not an annualized salary, because in that bill, they put in language that changed the definition of demotion. Right now, a teacher cannot make less than they made the year before. For example, I'm making $48,000 this year. Okay, this new budget, I come in there, you know, I get $50,000, but it's only a one-year contract, remember, because they've taken away tenure. The next year, they can change your salary and say, we're putting you into a different pay schedule, a different area, so we have no commitment, no legislation, no protection, to say that we have to continue to pay you at that salary. So more or less, we're telling everybody it's a one-time bonus.
So a lot of teachers in North Carolina have difficulty supporting their families. In fact, I think the teacher of the year from Mecklenburg County said,
yes,
that unless he got a raise, he would have to leave teaching or go to another system because he couldn't afford to support his family,
right,
which to me is a disgrace. Teacher pay in North Carolina is 46th. In the
yep.
nation, 10th out of the 12 southern states, mm-hmm. which, I mean, we're just above Mississippi, and they're always
right.
pointed to as the lowest.
Embarrassment, right.
If you had to sum up that finding in a sentence as vice president of the North Carolina Association of Educators, what would you say?
Yeah, I think, you know, James Ford said it the best. I was actually on the selection committee and his interview. He is a stellar representative of our profession. He came here for new opportunity from Illinois. He's got a great family, and you just can't afford to stay and live and teach in North Carolina. It's becoming a part-time job because of the pay. So teachers have to have, you know, some of them have two jobs in order to supplement it. You know, Mike, I came to North Carolina 17 years ago. I was recruited from West Virginia, from North Carolina. I had already had 10 years of experience there and a master's degree. And I looked at North Carolina as the new South. They told me, you need to come here because we're at the national average. You need to come here because we're going to pay you for your 10 years of experience. You need to come here because we're going to invest in small class size, teacher assistants, technology, guidance counselors, social workers, school psychologists. I had all of those resources in Oak Hill year-round elementary school in High Point, North Carolina, one of the most impoverished and impacted schools in the state. But I had the resources and tools to work with these kids and to make them successful. And we saw all of that wiped away last year in 5 months. So now we're getting what we feel is a few crumbs passed at us because it's an election year. They're looking at the poll numbers. This is going to be a mandate on the governor. The Tillis wants to go to Speaker Tillis wants to go to Congress and Senator Hagan's seat. So, you know, we know the game that's being played out there, but it's so much more than salary.
So how much should teachers make?
You know, we've always said a baseline salary needs to be at $45,000 for beginning teachers to be competitive, okay? Teachers need to be able to move up on a career pathway, you know, and not just creep up on the schedule that we have right now. I'll tell you right now, I agree with that comment that we have a broken teacher salary schedule. They shouldn't have to wait 36 years to make $55,000. We need to be able to invest in them and give them career opportunities to move up that ladder and have greater impact to stay in the classroom and reach those students.
And what should that ladder look like? How do you determine what teachers should be paid over time with experience?
Yeah, you know, there's some good models out there already in states that are using where they will have a tier system where they will move up every 3 to 5 years. And in several indicators, it's, you know, You know, they have like tier one would be, you know, were you able to get your master's degree? Did you get national board certification? You're going to move up to tier two. Are you taking on leadership roles at your school? Are you a team leader? Are you doing professional development? You move up into a different tier of pay. You know, all of those different things that will kind of motivate, you know, teachers to take on more responsibility, but also paying them for it and not just tying it to student test.
Among the topics that teachers will be discussing at this NEA meeting in Denver will be Common Core Standards. 45 states and the District of Columbia have passed that, but now North Carolina is having second thoughts, and Tuesday Republican lawmakers voted to repeal Common Core and pass the baton to the Senate. How do teachers feel about Common Core?
Yeah, you know what? You know, we did a survey, an independent organization came in here and did a survey of our members out there. 77% of them supported Common Core. Are there glitches and problems with it? Yes. Were the assessments not aligned? Yes. Were there some math issues with it or not being development, the curriculum not being developmentally appropriate for some of our lower grades? Yes. But we were going back to correct that. You can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We have been in the third year of the implementation of training and getting our students ready for this interconnected 21st century curriculum, and it was put forth by the National Governors Association. Most of them were Republicans, and the state councils of school chief officers, the school superintendents. They saw a need where we had to raise the bar in that learning and also have it connected when students are so mobile and going from state to state. That's all it was. But now it's been painted as by hysteria as some type of national federalized socialist education program, and that couldn't be farther from the truth. And it breaks my heart to see North Carolina throw all that work out and say, we're going to start over and write our own curriculum. We've been there. We've done that. And we saw it wasn't getting our students where they needed to be.
I wish we had more time, but we are completely out of time. Mark Jewell is Vice President of the North Carolina Association of Teachers, and I thank you for joining us this morning.
It's been my pleasure, Mike.
Very welcome.